This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, June 4th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. The murder of George Floyd by a Minneapolis police officer on Memorial Day has touched off a renewed public reckoning with the epidemic of racism in the United States. The history of racial prejudice in this country dates back to before the founding of the country, to the subjugation of Native Americans by early European colonists, and has continued through 250 years of slavery, 90 years of Jim Crow, and countless subsequent measures that deny Black Americans the rights promised in the Declaration of Independence and in the Constitution. This week, Reverend William J. Barber II, the president of the North Carolina chapter of the NAACP, spoke on CNN about the pain and fury behind the protests in cities across the United States.
America is in mourning. This protest is a form of mourning. It's not the first time, but it's what happens after a long train of abuses and wounds that we have only put band-aids on before. So you see the screaming, the anguish, the tears, the rage. It's born of multiple pandemics. We had the pandemic of poverty pre-existing, of the COVID, and then COVID happened. It exposed the wounds of racism, the wounds of poverty, then COVID, all the deaths there. And then we had this public lynching wolf right in front of us. And it's like pouring wound, the president's response to it and the death itself pouring wound. So when George said, "I can't breathe," it's like a collective gasp. It's like people saying, "I understand what that means."
Suzanne Plisak, an organizer and anti-racism trainer, is the co-founder with Dina Hayes Green of the Racial Equity Institute. She joins me to discuss how white Americans persist in misunderstanding racism in America and what needs to be done to change political, economic, and social disparities that plague the country. Suzanne, thanks so much for coming on the program.
Oh, you're most welcome.
You have been traveling around the U.S. for a few decades, teaching organizations and communities about how structural racism developed in this country and about how people can dismantle their preconceptions about race and society. So I want to put our cards on the table right away and point out that you're a white woman from the South and I'm a white woman from the North. And that will inform our discussion. How did you become engaged with this kind of work?
You know, you can go back any number of years, way past those last two decades. It's very difficult to really capture what all the touch points were, but to be a little white and linear, I can tell you essentially the path. If we all understand that nothing, of course, is as linear as it is when you lay it out in hindsight. I've found early in my life a real sadness for people who were hurt, who were harmed, who were living in poverty. After the birth of my children, that came into sharper focus. And as they enter school, it came into still sharper focus as I saw the contrast between what was available to my children and what was not available to children of color often. Not always, often. So it seemed to me at that time that the way we dealt with the child who came to school in flip-flops in January was to provide shoes. And it seemed to me at the time that provision of needs was very, very important. And it is important. It's not unimportant. But as you do that, you soon realize that you have done nothing to prevent those needs from occurring again. So I moved from that very charity approach, well-intended but ill-informed, into policy needs to be changed. We have got to do something in a larger way to get at the root causes. And so I spent some time working on public policy through various organizations and saw some glimmer of what I wasn't seeing from just providing a service. Of course, you don't do that very long before you realize that even when policy changes, that there is something else happening, that there is something in our culture, a narrative that continues to pull back those successes that you have. And I had the great gift of coming to a training that explained to me, that this one was from by the People's Institute at the time, that that thing was racism. And then 10 years ago, we decided to form the Racial Equity Institute and to do the work of bringing an analysis to people that would make them more effective in the work they do.
Many companies offer diversity training, but you know, those sessions have almost no effect, if any, on how white Americans go about their lives. So maybe you could talk a little bit about what makes the tactics and mission of the Racial Equity Institute different.
Yeah, we don't do diversity training. We don't do prejudice reduction. All of those things have their values, I'm sure. But even if you were able to make people more sensitive and reduce prejudice and bigotry and certain racial prejudice, you then send them out into a world that is operating from a structure that promotes the supremacy of white people, that ensures that whatever you do is going to disproportionately advantage white people, even when that's not your intent. So it is very easy for them then to be pulled back into that culture, into those structures, and nothing meaningful changes or happens. We believe that's because it is the structure that is at the root. It is, and under the structure, we say there's a groundwater, and that is that philosophical underpinning, those narratives of racism.
So how does your group define racism?
Well, we have a four-part definition. We define racism as social and institutional power plus race prejudice. Therefore, it is a system of advantage based on race. That's part two. Therefore, it is a system of oppression based on race. Therefore, it is a white supremacy system created by and dependent on an all-class collaboration called white, created to end cross-racial alliance and labor solidarity. The notion is racism was created to divide us. It's at the bottom of everything that ails us. And that division is just, it continues to work well because we don't understand it. We don't understand where it's coming from. And we continue to put it in the context of mean-spirited, racially charged people and statements and acts. Those things are bad. They're incredibly bad and wrong. But racism is deeper and more structural, more institutional, more a part of our cultural narrative than can be defined in individual people.
And I think this comes as a surprise to so many well-intended white people who insist that they are not racist. So there is a difference between, as you all say, between being not racist and being anti-racist. Could you tell us what that means?
Well, there's Eduardo Benita Silva wrote a wonderful book. He's at Duke, he's an incredible professor and author, and it's called Racism Without Racist. So if we wanted to just sort of spin in the semantics of it all, we can say that we have white people who are complicit in racist systems and beneficiaries of racist systems who are not themselves intentionally being racist. It's important to understand that racism happens, and this is the biggest lesson of my life, without my intent, that we are set up for it to happen. And so I have to understand that I benefit from that, whether I want to as a white person or not. I have to further understand it doesn't make me a bad, immoral person. It makes me a beneficiary of a system set up hundreds of years ago to benefit people who have come to be called white.
Can you give us an example of how a well-meaning organization you've worked with, determined to pursue racial diversity and all of the best values, has been taken aback by what you have to tell them?
Well, I think most of them are taken aback. But we were called some years ago to a public-private partnership, a school actually that had been created to be a multicultural school. They had all the very best intents. They, however, were having a very difficult time recruiting and retaining students and faculty of color. to their credit, they sensed something was in fact wrong, and they asked us to come and do a training and consult a bit with them, which we did. So the night before we did our training, the core of the school, all white, took us out to dinner, and they began to tell us all the things they had done to become multicultural. And it was a long list. They would bring in, one of their favorite things was to have what we call the International Day, you know, to bring in people from many cultures and have them share their culture and their cultural ways. And, that, you know, they brought in everybody. In addition to that, they did many things that they thought would be appealing to people of color. They would do spoken word. They would do stepping. They did, you name it, they did it. And our very wise director, Dina Hayes Green, said to them at the end of this litany, "So what did you do for white people?" And their jaw dropped. Because you see, the culture that was keeping them from attracting and retaining students and faculty of color was the one culture they had not examined. It's white culture. It's our way of being in the world, our set of values. And the invitation they issued is very much like the invitation we as white people have issued since the Civil Rights Act, which is come be like us. Don't bring your ways of being, don't bring your ways of knowing, come be like us.
So how should groups like that go about what they're doing? That's a huge project. It involves, you know, changing the deepest preconceptions that everyone has about him and herself.
We believe it starts with an understanding of how we got here. Then we need an understanding of how white organizational culture operates, how it is different from more relational cultures. We need an understanding that we are, in fact, as white people, not wrong and bad, but operating out of a culture that we impose on other people. It's okay to have your culture. It's okay to be who you are in the world based on your history. It's not okay to impose your way of being on everybody else and to make laws and build structures and build institutions based on that. And that's hard. That's hard. But that study, that understanding's got to be the first step.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
You know, so much of this problem, I think, derives from Americans' ignorance of our actual history as it played out. So I first heard about your work a few years ago when I was listening to Scene on Radio, a podcast that was presenting a phenomenal series called Scene White. And the premise of the series is that race is an invented concept used to entrench white people in positions of power. And on that show, you argue that the origins of the concept of whiteness, which is an artificial concept, stretches back hundreds of years. And I thought you could just tell our listeners a little bit about that.
Well, we made it up. I think that's the thing that's important to note. But to say that it is not biologically real, that it is a construction, a social construction, is only part of the story. The other part of the story is that it is profoundly politically and socially real. And it operates to the detriment of every single citizen of this country. And we have to understand that. So it was made up at a time when it was important to ensure that people of color who were either indentured servants or kidnapped and enslaved, and white people who were largely indentured servants, did not come together and challenge the system oppressing them. It was put in place to pacify the white indentured servant and say, we will give you some small thing over and above the kidnapped and enslaved African. And for that little something, we expect your loyalty. Your allegiance now is not to the black African you've been running away with. It is to the people who gave you this little thing. And we have done that as white people, knowingly and unknowingly, for the subsequent 300 years.
The story of John Punch really brings this home. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, John Punch was an African indentured servant. He was not kidnapped and enslaved, although it's a pretty fine line. This is early in the 1600s. John Punch was an African indentured servant who ran away with a Dutchman and a Scotsman. They ran away together, but they got caught. The Dutchman and Scotsman are sentenced to 4 additional years of servitude, 1 to the master to whom they were already indentured and 3 to the colony. But John Punch is sentenced to perpetual servitude. Now, that was done not because he was the leader or had some special part, although I'm sure there were all kinds of explanations in the time, but to ensure the allegiance of the white indentured servants to the white people at the top.
Virginia went on to become the largest slaveholding state on the eve of the Civil War. And also, when I was reading the papers this morning, when I woke up, I saw that Governor Ralph Northam of Virginia is expected to announce today that he'll order the removal of a statue of Robert E. Lee in Richmond, which was one of the many monuments there that have been vandalized during the protests. So it's just really interesting to see this long arc that has brought us to where we are today.
It is indeed.
The protests following the killing of George Floyd do seem to have had some clear effect.
Yes.
The 4 officers involved in Floyd's killing have been indicted. The mayor of Los Angeles has announced plans to cut the police budget in the city and redirect those funds toward communities of color. And after President Trump's abysmal response to the protests, 3 former presidents, Barack Obama, George W. Bush, and Jimmy Carter, have issued statements in support of the protesters. It looks to me like this could be an inflection point. Does it look that way to you?
It absolutely does. I mean, the question is sustaining the momentum, showing up, not just for the protests, but when the protests are over, showing up again the next day. And the next, for all the things that we need to continue to fight for. That's my prayer. That's my hope. That's my prayer. But they have been important. I mean, they have clearly made some difference.
You know, Obama is such an important voice in all of this for all of the obvious reasons. And in his statement yesterday, he asked mayors to review use of force policies and pursue a specific program of police reforms that his administration developed. How does your group encourage this kind of countrywide political reform at the grassroots level?
Well, what we teach is that the things that we face in this world, the injustice that we face in this world, organizing is essentially the answer. That we need to learn to organize outside of institutions and inside of institutions. That building a base of power to challenge power at those grassroots levels and then beyond that is what we need to be doing. I mean, it is the work. And that means you've got to show up again the next day.
So there is a tendency after incidents of racially motivated violence in white culture, and you can see it right now playing out in the media, to ask people of color for their insights about racism. But scholars and activists, and even some of our recent presidential candidates, have been pointing out what you're pointing out, that systemic racism is really a white problem. So what role do conversations among white communities or conversations between white people like you and I are having play in confronting and addressing the problem of systemic racism?
Well, I think that they can play a very big role. The potential, I would say, is absolutely there. I have been somewhat heartened by the number of statements that companies and organizations and individuals have come out with condemning these recent acts of brutal, unconscionable violence. So to speak out against such things is always an important thing to do. We had a mentor years ago who said, if you can get three white people with no people of color present to speak out against racism, you've done revolutionary work. I didn't believe it until I tried.
Wow.
But that speaking is important. And to stop at that will be the tragedy compounding the tragedy. I mean, one of the things that should be respectfully and compassionately asked of all of these statements, all of these speakers, is where have you been? There have been opportunities every day to speak out against, to stand against institutional racism. Where have you been in the health disparity, racial health disparities, horror, the achievement gap, the disparities in lending, in the justice system? You know, where are companies who built their wealth on the back of people of color and poor people and now say these are the people with whom we stand? I mean, that has to be examined. We've got to ask ourselves, where have we been as this problem, this institutional structural problem continued to take stronger and stronger hold of our country?
I see promise, and I assume you do too, in the new generation of leaders. Many of us are being introduced to for the first time, thanks to what has been unfolding. But just look at the number of Black mayors who have made incredibly important statements about all of this. Keisha Bottoms in Atlanta, Muriel Bowser in Washington, Lori Lightfoot in Chicago. And then I saw this morning, 6 years after the killing of Michael Brown, the first Black mayor of Ferguson, Ella Jones.
Mm. I think, too, that we must be careful. Do not be too naive. Because we have people of color heading cities and heading institutions and heading all of those things doesn't mean that they will not be continually challenged by the very nature of those institutions, by the very nature of our local governments and state governments and federal governments. So it's a both and. We need that. We need that desperately. And the fact that it has occurred is the greatest of good news. And it doesn't end the work. They will face a system that is unchanged by their presence. And we have to work to change it.
Thank you so much, Suzanne, for joining me.
Well, you are just very welcome, and I wish you well and all the work you do, and know that it's appreciated.
Likewise. Suzanne Plisak is a co-founder of the Racial Equity Institute, located in Greensboro, North Carolina, where she also works as an anti-racism trainer and organizer. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.